I said earlier, I am really honored to be asked to speak on this important topic. Wayne called me last summer. He and I had visited, and I've been thinking on this for a good while, particularly the theme of proving all things. When we read of those noble Bereans who received the word gladly and searched the scriptures daily to see whether those things were so, I began to think a long time ago about what that means. And some things that, in my own experience, quite a bit of time, improving. I preached, as many of you have, to audiences that we ought to prove, and to search it, and to do it. But I used to assume that everybody could read it and they could do it. Some recent experiences have illustrated to me that that may not necessarily be so. Let me share with you some examples. Many of you probably know that I work at a university and work with reading education, direct a reading laboratory where we work with children. A few years ago, there was a lady called me for her young daughter, about 10 or 11, who was having reading problems. She, with her daughter, came into my office. She sat down, and I explained to her how that we could, thought we could be able to help her. Her daughter, who was about 10 or 11, could not read. After I talked to her to give her hope, she looked at me, and I'll never forget that look in that face of a woman who's about mid-30s. Tears welled in her eyes, and she said, "Do you think you could help me learn to read?" There's a 35-year-old man who called and came in. He says, "I can't read." I thought that took a lot of courage from him. He says, "One thing I want to do is to read some books to my daughter." I will never forget the joy that he expressed when he came back and with a little children's book, and the joy that he was able to read that to his daughter, and she respond something that each of us take for granted. I couldn't help but think about that because I'm concerned with more things than my job. In fact, I see that secondary to my life. I began to wonder if there are people in the church like that. There was a man I know very, very well, a man in the church. After I had known him for about 6 or 7 years, I was getting on his case pretty good one time about reading and studying some things. And he, in sort of a broken voice, said, "LG, I can't read very well." And I wondered how many times I had preached to audiences, to people who could not read it, could not understand it. I wondered if that was a major problem. About 3 years ago, Jonathan Kozol, the author of The Illiterate America, spoke on our campus and draw attention to some literacy information that helped me to see that this is not really a small problem. In fact, our best data today, that is sponsored by research by Ford Corporation and others, there's something on the order of 25 million, and I say again, 25 million functionally illiterate adults in the United States today. By that, it means that these people cannot read well enough to read the warnings on pesticide labels or on other kinds of things. The question I raise, while I'm concerned about reading pesticide labels, I'm concerned, can they read their Bibles? Can they read for what we take for granted? 25 million. Richard and I talked about a month ago, and he had shared with me some of the things that he mentioned this morning about the restoration preachers and their concerns for the people who could not read the Word, making the translations and try to get it so they could handle it. I checked some data, and when he was writing that in 1826, the entire population of the United States was less than 13 million. There are more than twice as many functionally literate adults in the United States than the entire population of the United States in 1820. But what about those people, those common people? Those lower class, those people who are without, the people who are illiterate, who don't read well, do they really want to read the Bible? 2 years ago, when Jonathan Kozol spoke on our campus, he talked about visiting the literacy centers that had different places in New York, in San Francisco, in Houston, in Dallas, and in Lubbock. He talked to people standing in line to learn to read. Most of the people didn't do it because they wanted a better job. They said they wanted to because they wanted to read to their children. And he says, very frequently, the people said, I want to learn to read so I could read the Bible. There was one 80-year-old lady standing there and said, why did the person like you at your age want to do that? She said, there's one thing I want to do before I die, and that's to read a book. And my thought is that to be able to read the book of books. It's against that backdrop that caused me to think about, what about our translations? I had heard that the King James Bible was difficult to read. There are readability formulas. I've done some on selections. The data that I have, based on normative data of reading tests and readability analysis of the Bible, indicate that about 4 to 5% of college graduates would have difficulty reading and understanding the King James Version. I say that again, 4 to 5%. That's with college graduates. If you line them up, 1 out of every 20 would have difficulty. 9% of persons with high school graduation, that would be 1 out of every 11, would have difficulty reading with understanding. I would love to do a study, and there are techniques by which to do that, to see how many that there are. One of the things that I find, however, when we're thinking about getting materials to deal with, that we can do one of two or three things. Three options, I think, that are available to us in view of this situation. And I think we have sufficient data that there are numbers of people who cannot read as well as they would like. One of the things that's disturbing to me is that I think if I couldn't read with all the pressures that there are on it, and somebody told me that they should, I think I would have to feel very, very safe to say, I'm sorry, I can't read this book. And I just wonder how many people there are in the church that when we speak, when we urge for them to study and give attendance to reading, who cannot do it or cannot do it very well. They're not likely to say, I can't read. And there may be more than we realize. And the studies of this indicate that many people really have developed extremely effective ways of covering it up. But I'm concerned too about all the people in the world who cannot gain access to get access to the Word. And it's not for just us only. One of the things that I see happening, that there are a lot of other people share this concern, and I was talking to Wayne just a little bit earlier, that one of the thesis of my presentation this afternoon is that we need more readable material to get it accessible. And one of those things that we can do out of those three options is one, that we can either get easier reading material, that is, Bibles that are written in more easily understood material, or we can do as has been done and is done with some churches, is increase the reading level of people. Numbers of churches are involved right now with literacy programs, and their prime mission for that is in order to do this. As I thought about that, I'm reminded of a classic work in the field of reading, and it's called American Reading Instruction by Nala Benton Smith, her doctoral research. She's looking at reading instruction in the United States, and one of her chapters is dealing with the reading, with the focus of reading instruction. During the colonial period, it was religious emphasis. I've lost my notes here. I've got notes and notes and notes. But the main focus of the people who came to the United States during the early period, that they were a religious people. They came here for getting away from religious suppression. We all know that from our American history. What we may not realize and not have registered as clearly was that one of the reasons they established the schools in this country was so the people could read the Bible. I was struck with that, where the person is gaining a PhD in dissertation who had apparently no religious concerns as far as, I don't know how much she had, but that was the focus, the primary thing, because people's souls were at stake. And so they're going to increase the reading ability of their children and their society so that they could gain access to the Word to be able to respond to it. So we could get involved in that. I'm not sure that the church, and I'm not ready to support running schools to improve the literacy of people in order to gain access to the Word, is a simpler solution to this. Or we may then exercise a third option, say it's no problem of mine. I'm familiar with the King James and the other material, doesn't seem all that hard to me. And just let it go with that. I'm concerned that we can't let it go with that. And we're at a pivotal point, I think. One of the things that I see in my experience, and I'm not sure whether mine is representative, and we have a group here who has a much greater grasp of this than I have as to really what is the situation. But I see in the congregations where I am that we're changing whether we want to or not. We have persons who are using the Amplified, the New King James, the American Standard, the Revised Standard, the New International is very popular. You may have seen the report that the evangelical group indicate that this fall, for the Christmas sales of Bibles, which are always popular, that this fall is the first time in the history of this country that any Bible, any version, has exceeded the King James, that the New International is outselling the King James this Christmas season. That tells us something. It's also being used in the church. Now, I have difficulty with dealing with this topic because, and let me illustrate that so that you sort of know where you are. There's an intellectual side of this and there's an emotional side. The intellectual side of me says we need to do this, we need to move quickly and with post-haste with it. But the Bible that I have and from which I read is the King James Version. It's what I preached with. About a year and a half ago, the back came off. And I had a decision to make. Am I going to buy another one? Or am I going to have this one rebound? And incidentally, I bought this book in 1955 from Jack Cutter. And I made the decision to have it rebound because I had all my notes in it. I preached from it and it's familiar. And that's while I've been involved in this study. So it sort of tells you we're not dealing with an easy task. But I did the other day take the New International and did that for a chapter study. One of the things that I saw happen in the audience, we've got Bibles in our pews, King James Bibles, just like most congregations do. When I started reading, I got up to read the text. Several people reached and got the Bibles, pulled them out to follow along in the study. When I started reading and I watched the audience, one of the things I noticed that people were kind of with that confused look that teachers tend to have a way of seeing. Pretty soon that I saw them start folding them up, putting them on the pews, and kind of lean back and do this. In a business meeting, one of the men said, you know, I wonder if we can't get us some other books. If we're going to read from the other translations, shouldn't we have books there so they can read and follow along? And that's a compelling argument to me. But it's faced with which one do you get? And I don't have an answer to that one yet. I think we have to decide whether we're going to do something. And if we decide we're going to do something, then we've got to decide what we're going to do. And I'm here today, and it's the thesis of what I'm doing, suggesting, is that we need to make a change. But I am perplexed, I tell you, after an intensive study on this, is what we change to. That's a whole other area. And so I'd like to deal with some things. One of the things that this is a sensitive area. I've had several people say to me when they saw the topic, says, man, I'm interested in what you're going to say, what are you going to do? And I've had a long-distance phone call from an individual who talked for 20 minutes on why we ought to be staying with the King James Bible. So we're touching some red buttons. And I don't know how many red buttons I'm touching in this audience. And by that meaning, persons who feel that we should not change and we should not tamper with God's Word. And that sort of leads me into some things. You could have made this list, I'm sure, that I've got on here. I put together a rather lengthy handout on this to deal with some topics because I I have trouble remembering and getting things down in particular. And as I was telling Wayne before, sometimes we lose sight of why we had, why were the writing systems and why Bibles were ever started and began with. The only reason we have a Bible is because people don't remember very well, get things confused, and so we write it down so it will stay. And I tell you, there's a lot of prayer and thought went into what I've committed, and I, like Tyndale, and when he turned his Bible loose, he put in his preface to it, he says, if you find anything in there, you let me know. And so I'm here to ask you today, we got some things in here that need to be examined. If I know my heart, there's one thing that I want to do, and that's to please God. And I tell you, this, I feel like I'm treading where angels fear to trod, talking here today, and the thesis that I'm taking on this. And I tell you that I have prayed much about this, and I ask and solicit your prayers for all of us as we examine a very, very important topic. Because what we're dealing with is whether that how we deal and define our North Star, where we get our bearings, what's really valid, and where we anchor ourselves. Because when we are going to prove all things, we must be able to say that this is something I can rely on. So let's take a look. Let me tell you what I plan to do now at this point. I want to go through some reasons that have been advanced why we should stay with the King James. I'm going to look at some reasons that have been advanced for why that we might ought to consider something else. And then I want to review the evidence and to prove some things and to look at some things in relationship to this that I think are important for us to think about as we examine this, what I see as a crucially important topic. We're dealing with people's souls. On the one hand, of making it readable. On the other hand, of making sure it's doctrinally sound. And the thing that scares me right now is that I see other translations that are being used and hearing them and working with them. And I'm afraid because of the difficulty of the reading, people are getting materials that are easier to read. We can't control that. That's the liberty that's available to people, and the free press makes that, and that is going to occur. The thing that concerns me is that it is going to change. What I'm afraid that may happen is that we may select a bad version by default, and that is scary. And I have a 3-page portion of this deals with guidelines for looking at versions, and I would invite your attention to those and to think about them, things that I think are important. Let me note some things quickly. I'll respond to a little bit, and then I want to move into some transparencies and some other kinds of materials. One reason that people insist on the King James, for many people, it is the Bible. Most of us grown up with it. It's familiar. We've heard it as Timothy from our childhood. It just rings in our ear. And if there's one thing, and I'm not bad-mouthing the King James, it is an outstanding book. The not only the substantive and doctrinal aspect of it and the soundness of the translation is marvelous, but it has a ring. It has a majestic quality about the language that inspires readers and it exalts God. And it has been unequal. That's why it stood the test of 379 years. And so for most of us, for many people, it is the Bible. For many, we hold to it by tradition. And it was pointed out earlier today that not all traditions are bad. Something is handed down. Good things can be handed down too. And so some people do it because they've been preached and they have responded to what we have preached. Do not add to nor take from a warning that's worth hearing. That there have been people who have, that if though I or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel, and for many, if that varies from what I've heard, let them be accursed. And so if anything doesn't sound right, doesn't ring true, that doesn't sound like what I know in my Bible, that doesn't look like the Bible. And I would remind us that most of what we see and what we hear, wolves in sheep's clothing mostly look like sheep. And it's only when you see what looks like might be a tail, what might look like a paw instead of a hoof, then you alert, there may be something here. So anytime there's any variance, so, but others, because they see it as the authorized version. I want to point this out, that of all the history of I've looked at, and I've read the preface, I've read lots of historical information in preparation for this, related to the King James Version, and I'll just call attention lest I forget it, that there's an excellent book on the King James Bible translators by Ophel. This is on your on here, and it's flagged as that on the history and information on your reference list at the end of this. But this gives us a lot of information about it, but there is no information that we have that the King James Bible was ever authorized by anybody. The printers put that on it because it sells. And King James indeed commissioned the Bible, but in terms of its being authorized any more than any other version, there's no evidence that that is true. It stood the test of 379 years, as the one other argument that's been given. We owe much to our spiritual heritage to that, and one could hardly argue against it. It's worked well in converting thousands, and indeed it has. Some people believe it to be from a better Greek text, the received text, than more recent versions. That is an area that I think that we really need to study, and I know that some of our brethren are doing some work in that area as to whether that it's one the received or some of the Nestle, Westcott Report, the United Bible Society's text or whatever. My topic has not dealt with textual criticism, and I'm not prepared to pursue that, but that is an important issue in this whole matter, is the text on which it is. You have a handout here. Let me just call attention to it, that on the right-hand side of this, it shows the New Greek New Testament, that it was translated from the Greek. That orange paper, orange band there looks like that would all be from the same one. It is not. That Greek was the same Greek language, but there were at least three or four different Greek texts. We have no originals. Most of you know that. So that there is some things in there that need to be examined. Why change? It doesn't seem to be broken. It's been working okay. I think this is to ignore some information we've looked at earlier. Some are not changing because of expedience. It's going to offend some people. And some don't want to change because they've not found an acceptable alternative. I'm at that point right now. Why some people insist on using is to find others much easier to understand, and indeed that is important. There is a scriptural base for that, and I want to deal with it now, lest we forget that. It's in 1 Corinthians 14. He's not talking about writing, but he's talking about communicating in the church. You know that chapter very, very well. But I want to call attention to verse 9, where he says, "Likewise ye, except ye utter by the tongue words easy to be understood, how shall it be known what is spoken? For ye shall speak into the air." Utter words easy to be spoken. In the early church, there were people who were endowed with various gifts. We've talked a lot about tongues, that ability to speak to people in their own language. And we know very well that on the day of Pentecost, that when the apostles stood up to speak, that they spoke, and every man heard him speak in the tongue wherein that they were born. That has been a theme throughout time. I am not unaware of 1 Peter 1, where it says that he has uttered words, some words, hard to be understood. I think it's important and instructive to note that the adjective there is some and not most or all. But the thesis there is that it would be words easy to be understood. And in every case, that if it was hard to be understood, they were put into the church individuals whose responsibility it was to interpret. It may be dealing with hard words, it may be for foreign language, and to translate that so the people could understand, so everyone would be edified. So we have biblical reasons for making it so the people could understand it. I would like now to note that language change has made the King James Version easy to understand for made it no longer easy for the common person to understand it. I hear sometimes that the King James is, that they made mistakes in the translation because some words mean this instead of meaning that. My study and thought on this was that in 1611, words meant things different, and it was a good translation in 1611. And I think that is crucially important to this whole thing. It is not that it was a bad translation. Instead, I want to read from the preface, if I can find it, the preface to the original King James Version. And I just want to show you some things, and I've got some time here. I didn't know it, that the King James, this is a copy of a facsimile that's in the rare book collection at Texas Tech University Library. The original 1611 Bible was this size. This is one of the, this was the first one that was printed. It's ornate. It says on here that it was containing the Old Testament and the New, newly translated out of the original tongues, with the former translations diligently compared and revised by His Majesty's special commandment. And here's the way it looks. Now, what often is not, and I have not found any King James Version today that has the original preface in it. And to understand some things about this on language change, there's some things that we must understand about it that the original, the translators themselves pointed out. That they were not going to make, and let me read this so I make sure I quote it right. Page 157 is about a 13-page long preface, because they had they expected a lot of controversy over the 1611. And lest I forget it, it took about 30 or 40 years after the King James Bible came in before it was generally accepted. One of the ironies that's spelled out in one of these books, that one of the prominent figures, and these were all prominent scholars at Oxford and Cambridge and Westminster, who worked on it, 47 scholars that did it, outstanding work, outstanding credentials that they each had. But one of the ironies of that, that King James attended the church where one of the translators preached after it had been released. And he quoted and read from the Geneva Bible, and not the King James. Geneva Bible and the Bishop's Bible was the primary one, and they were having difficulty with it. But listen to what they wrote in it. It says, "But it is high time to leave them and to show in brief what we proposed ourselves for what course we held in our pursual and survey of the Bible. Truly, good Christian reader, we never thought from the beginning that we should need to make a new translation, nor yet to make a bad one a good one, but to make a good one better, and out of the many good ones, one principal good one, not justly to be accepted against, that hath been our endeavor, that our mark, to make a good translation better." So that was their purpose and intent. They were not saying that they had bad ones, but instead to make a good one better. I thought after I visited, as I related those events and things sort of led to my way of getting in here, I thought maybe I'd kind of come up with some original thought that we need to get an easier Bible to read. And when Richard shared what he did this morning about the restoration preachers saying, you know, these people can't understand that, it's hard to come up with original thought. And one other thing I found is in the preface to the King James Bible, and some people have thought that was for really the lofty folks. And they've got their best scholars at Oxford and Cambridge and at Westminster to do it. But I want to read you a segment from this that I think that is instructive 379 years, and I didn't know this, but he says, "But how shall men meditate in that which they cannot understand?" Skipping a few lines, they said, "Translation, it is that openeth the window to let in the light, that breaketh the shell, that we may eat the kernel, that putteth aside the curtain, that we may look into the most holy place, that removeth the cover of the well, that we may come by the water, even as Jacob rolled away the stone from the mouth of the well, by which means the flocks of Laban were watered. Indeed, without translation into the vulgar language," and vulgar didn't mean what verbal vulgar does today, it meant common, or that language of the mob. "But indeed, without translation into the vulgar tongue, The unlearned are but like children at Jacob's well, which was deep, without a bucket or something to draw with, or as the person mentioned by Isaiah, to whom, when a sealed book was delivered with this motion, "Read this, I pray thee," he was fain to make this answer, "I cannot, for it is sealed." This was printed in every copy of the first King James Bible that was printed in 1611. It has long since been removed, and it's not there. I'd like to draw attention to a chart that's in the second page in, to draw attention to some things regarding language change and needs for translations. We have information here of persons like the translators of the King James, the restoration preachers, along with some of us who are saying we need something different. But I'd like to look at this from a historical perspective, and I'd like for us to start backwards. Start with me. If you're going to go for proofs of something, I'd like for us to note, when you look at that, indeed that the Word of God endureth forever. Some people argue that God's Word is going to endure forever, and you go changing it with versions and so forth, you got a problem. And some people, as they see the King James as being the Bible, some people think that's what Paul and some of the apostles preached from, which indeed it wasn't. But I'd like you to note something, and I prepared this handout particularly for our own use, but as you go and as you're talking to others to help understand something that I think is really important of this, note with me on this chart that the year B.C. A.D. at the time of Christ. Let's start in the year 1990. Here we are today. And if we're going to prove all things, and the King James is the only book that we can use, let's start and see how far we can go back in history until we don't have a King James that could be used. Note, if you will, at the bottom, that the King James Version goes back to 1611, and there is no King James. Any person who lived earlier than that could not have access to it. There were English translations that went back, as you look here, and others. But I'd like to look at, in fact, if you go on back to the year 449 AD, 400 years after Christ lived, there was no English language. We are so culture bound, it's important for us to help us to kind of look at things. We have grown so accustomed to thinking because that English is spoken all over the world. I understand there are more Oxford English dictionaries sold in Japan than there are in the whole United States. More people studying English in China than the whole population of the United States right now. English is the world, the language of commerce. We see English as the language, and in fact, we are so opposed to foreign languages in our schools and everything that nobody studies the foreign language. If they want to talk with me, they can learn my language. That is not true. We are so egocentric in our language orientation. We are so easy to forget and to be locked in that there's a whole other world out there. And we're talking about proving things. This is to say nothing of all the other translations. I understand, according to information, the American Bible Society and others indicate that the Bible has been translated into 250 different languages as the whole Bible, and that the parts of the Bible into 1,900 different languages. I didn't know there were that many, but it's all in that. But if we just take English alone, and if we are tunnel vision, and that it's English, we run out of English in 449 A.D. And before that, you had to do something else. In fact, it was Latin at that time. And before that, it was Greek. And before that, it was Hebrew. Now, I want you to come back with me on this as we follow this chart back through. And I'd like you to notice some things with me that I think it can be documented in history. It's beyond the scope of our time to deal with this now, but it's central to our thesis. Is that God spoke to his people in Hebrew back with Abraham some close to 2,000 years before Christ. After the Babylonian captivity and the people were dispersed, and the Greeks gained control of the world, and as God was setting the stage for his coming of Christ, that the Greek language took into force about 1,400 years before Christ. And as we can see on that chart, the Greek language, 1400 years, and a little bit before Christ, that the Jewish people were speaking Greek primarily because that was the language of the people, and that's the way language works. We learn whatever we're working around. And there became a need for the people to be able to read it. And there is a book that many of you have heard of, the Septuagint, which literally means 70, where 70 scholars in 70 sessions translated it. And their prime reason for doing that was get it so those Hebrew texts could be read by the common person, which the language is Greek. And I believe that can be documented in history. Greek language was the universal language at the time of Christ, and that's what they preached in, what they spoke in. And I understand, and I think George Batty has a lesson on it. I haven't had a chance to talk with him about this, but the Greek text that I see where they says, thus it is written, the scripture saith, this is over and over again, that's in Greek when the original was in Hebrew. They brought it over, which to me is evidence that the Word of God is not in what particular language or the particular word, but the Word of God, there's ideas, His will, His message, in whatever language, but that was brought over into Greek. And then Greek, you know, all good things seem to come to pass. And then that just before Christ, that the Latin language, and Latin incidentally started only a couple of hundred years before Christ. We think of it as being so old, indeed it is. But Greek language lost its prominence and Latin came into play, and by about 150 years after Christ's birth, that there was a need to translate the Bible into other languages. They translated into Coptic, which was the Egyptian language. They translated into Latin, the Old Latin. And by 300, there was a great need because not many people could read their Greek Bibles anymore. And about 300 years later, that Jerome was commissioned to refine the Old Latin Bible, and the Latin Vulgate was developed. I'd heard Latin Vulgate all of my life, and just one day I just sort of thought, Vulgate, that sounds an awful lot like vulgar to me. I wonder if there's any connection. So I'm interested in languages, and I went back, and sure enough, it's from the Latin word vulgare, which means mob or common. The Latin Vulgate was the language of the common people, Latin, at that time. It's not that way anymore. But I think that it is instructive to note that about 300 years after the Latin Vulgate came on the scene, people's language changed, it changed, and it changed, and it got so that only the preachers and the clerics were the only ones who knew it and could read it very well. It says, trust me, trust me. And if you know what happened in the 600 AD, the rise of the papacy and the Roman Catholic Church and the Pope came into play. I think there's instructive here. When the common people can't get access, it went through the Dark Ages. It was coming out of the Dark Ages. In fact, it was in the latter part of it that persons who were preaching, such persons as the during the 900 years or so after Christ, that they were preaching, and they said that we've got to get this so that people can understand. And these preachers, the priests that were going, is mostly Catholics, they were writing in the margins, in between the margins of the Latin Bibles and the old Anglo-Saxon. And the Greek, when the Greek, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes came from Northern Europe into England in 449, they brought with them their language, and it was from that we get the English language. In fact, English comes from the land of the Angles, Angli, they called them. And it was the land of the Angli, those people who'd come in there and started the English language. They lived through this and developed, but it got to developing prominence such that in about 900 years, that they were writing in the margins in the first interlinears. I would like for us to kind of get a flavor for how much the language has changed. It's one thing to say that language has changed. It's another to gain a sense of how much it's changed. Now, I don't know how accurate that this is, but one of the linguistic tapes that I have, and I brought a copy of it, is of the Lord's Prayer being read in the language in the year 1000, and in the year 1300. I'm going to play that right now. But before I do, I want to just show you what it looked like. This is a copy of the Lord's Prayer in the year 950. Now, you talk about language change. Anybody here can read it? Now, the bottom line, if somebody knows Latin, I think that the bottom line is Latin with the English, Anglo-Saxon written above it. By the year 1384, when Wycliffe did his first translation, this is what it looked like. Still not real easy. You can sort of make out some of it. But about 300 years of language change. And by contrast, if you come on up to Tyndale in the year 1500, it's getting a little bit closer to what we can handle. But these are copies, I understand, of what it looked like in those days. Now then, not only in its appearance and its reading is it hard, but even the language changed in its sound. I want to play for a tape now for you to hear. It's got a little bit of stuff, and I hope it works out okay. The first, well, it's signal, so we'll just listen.
Place. And language is a function of time. Listen to the Lord's Prayer as it sounded nearly 600 years ago. Our Father, that art in heavenest, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come unto, be thy will done as in heaven and in earth. Give to us this day our bread, our other substance, and forgive unto us our debtors, as we forgive unto our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen.
Then, quite soon after the Norman conquest, English had obtained a French to it. But let's jump back beyond 1066 and listen to English in its hard, Teutonic infancy as Anglo-Saxon. The Lord's Prayer in the year 1000 A.D.
Fede ura sus eert und hoffnum sit in name gehalget. To become us in rica. I wura das in willa on jorten swas warn hoffnum. Urne gedeich warmlich in schlaf sila us to day. And forgive us ura guiltus swas where we forgive us ura guiltendum. And ne gelied zu us on kostninga. Ag alisus of infele. Sos rica.
Now, I don't know whether the English would change that much in the future than it has in the past. The point is this, that language is changing, we cannot change that, and that we must address that. I'd like now to draw your attention to the second chart. And I'll just say a couple of words about this because I want to move on into some other things here. But some other events, if you'll notice that in the Dark Ages and the changes, the things that were going on with in around 1500, you know when it, someone asked the question this morning, do you come out with translations when there are great major movements coming? Well, that's what happened in the Reformation period, that when people started trying to break away from the captivity of the Roman Catholic Church, that translations began to come out, and you'll see several of those, and that the various translations and so forth. And that I did want to call attention to this right-hand column. You'll notice along the right-hand column, there where it says the first printed book, the Gutenberg Bible, then the English breaks from Rome, then Tyndale's translation. In 1534, Henry VIII made the break, and then the Great Bible, the Geneva Bible, and incidentally, the Geneva Bible was the one that was used by the Puritans, and that in contrast to the Bishop's Bible, I understand that it was a Geneva Bible, someone mentioned this morning, that was brought with the pilgrims in 1620 to the Plymouth Colony. And later, I understand they had a King James Bible on it, with them. But it was all happening in that period, and that indeed came over. What I'd like to note now, and time will not permit there, is just to note some things on a chart that comes on this. The potential sources of reading problems due to 379 years of change. If you'll note this next page, look at the obsolete words that are in the King James Bible. you wonder about the that first top of that page, the words, are those real familiar? Those, you take your, I started to put the verses down on those for them, but instead I just refer you to a Strong's or Young's to look them up. You know, we have lived, many of us, in the church so long, and we just kind of skip over some things and go over them. I was amazed that there were that many. I've got a list of several others that are tough to understand, and I decided not to put them in. I ran out here at 20 pages on this. But look at the sentences, not only the words, but look at the sentences. What does it mean in Job 36:33? The noise thereof showeth concerning it, the cattle also concerning the vapor. Now, if you go by and you can define every word, but what does that mean? Moreover, brethren, we do you to wit of the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia. If we've heard lots of explanations and studied that, we probably know what he means by that. Okay, thanks. And there are several others that are given here. But the major concern is words that are in the King James Bible now that are common usage that have a different meaning. And I have several examples of that. And I think that is the most scary area of all. If this says, fetch the compass, I know I don't know what that means. But if they say nephews, I said, I know what nephews are. But may not realize that nephews in 1611 meant any descendant, whether nephew or not. And I've confirmed that with the Oxford English Dictionary. I have a citation on here, and if you don't know the Oxford English Dictionary, that is a source of what words meant at different times. And I find that it just lines right up with vines and so forth, and that was mentioned earlier. Different spellings. Time will not permit me to go into detail on this. I've provided some various examples of, a couple of pages over on different translations, how they can help. Take, for example, someone who is a novice reads, teaching things they ought not for filthy lucre's sake. I'm reading that, teaching things they ought not to teach, and that for dishonest gain. That communicates today. Or that firkins, two or three firkins apiece, each jar held about 20 or 30 gallons. Basically, what the translators have done has helped us to understand and change the language. A book I didn't know about, which I have a copy right here, and I've got some samples on, is the Bible from 26 translations, can be helpful. But I want to draw attention now, in closing, to some guidelines for selecting a Bible version. And I wrote this out because I knew I was going to run out of time, and so I just wrote down and added to it. I just want to call attention to the, although I've argued in my main thesis, we need to get it so it's easy to read, but the number one first criterion on this list is it safe, sound, reliable source for helping me to learn what was God's original message. Now, there's a reason for wording it that way, because you can use lots of different terms.